May it please the court. My name is Carrie Hershey, registration number 2434246, and I represent Dr. Judy Bach. I've represented Dr. Bach for more than 8 years, ever since a disabling mental illness left her unable to safely practice medicine and care for patients. Faced with such an illness, Dr. Bach did several things. She notified the Colorado Medical Board and entered an agreement to refrain from practice until she was safe to practice. She notified her practice partner and the hospital where she worked. When it became clear that she would be unable to return to practice soon, she worked with her practice to notify patients. You've read in the briefs of Horizon and Dr. Oster, and you will likely hear again today about Dr. Bach's erratic behavior during this time. The conduct of a mentally ill person rarely makes sense, and it's irrelevant to the issues before the court. The issue in this appeal is straightforward. Is an award of attorney's fees based on a prevailing party provision in a contract void or a nullity when the judgment upon which that fee award is based is overturned on appeal?
Counsel, is this just the fee award, or is also the award costs as well?
It's the cost and fee award, Your Honor. Thank you, Counsel. The law is as equally straightforward as the question.
You mean we have a case in Colorado on this point?
Bainbridge, Your Honor. Bainbridge versus Douglas County Board of Commissioners, 55 P3rd 271.
Was Bainbridge brought under Rule 60? Was that a relief sought under Rule 60?
Bainbridge was not, as I recall, brought under Rule 60. As I recall the Bainbridge holding, there had been an award of costs and fees in an original case. The case was appealed. There's a second award of costs and fees, and the question was whether or not the first award stood. And Bainbridge, which was cited as recently as 2012 in the Ryder v. State Farm case, tells us that when an underlying judgment is reversed, an award that is dependent on that judgment for its validity is also necessarily reversed and becomes a nullity. Bainbridge is, I believe, therefore directly on point and holds that an award previously entered on a judgment that's been reversed is no longer valid because on remand, that judgment no longer exists. The Bainbridge holding is also consistent with Colorado Supreme Court precedent that provides us equally straightforward direction. The International Society for Krishna Consciousness case holding commented that when an initial judgment favorable to the complaining party is reversed on appeal, no valid claim to attorney's fees could be asserted. It also talks in that case about a relief under a mistake of law cannot stand. Bainbridge is also consistent with earlier precedent from this very court, the Nagy versus Landau case, which holds that an award of attorney's fees is null when a judgment supporting that fee award is reversed, and Nicholas versus Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Railroad. Several arguments are advanced to avoid these precedents, and none of these can avoid the plain rulings of the court. First, you'll hear, and plaintiffs have indicated in their briefing, that the trial court issued its award, its June 21st, 2011 award of costs and fees, and I'm quoting from the answer brief, quote, citing both the employment agreement and the buy-sell agreement. A review of the record, however, does not support the assertion that the buy-sell agreement was ever used as a basis for awarding costs or fees.
Well, it was on remand, wasn't it? Or it was recognized as a basis for costs and fees on remand, wasn't it?
Your Honor, it was supplanted in the order on denying the Rule 60 motion.
Thank you, not on remand, thank you.
And what What's important about that is twofold. First, that order essentially said it could not, the court could not set aside the earlier fee award, even though the underlying basis for that award had been reversed on appeal, because the court said it didn't have jurisdiction. It nonetheless turned around and then supplanted the buy-sell agreement as a secondary basis for the fee award. That's problematic not only because it's contradictory in terms of the jurisdiction of the court, but also because of the rules that govern requesting awards for costs and attorney's fees. The rules of civil procedure require...
Counsel, isn't there another reason why there's a problem with relying on the buy-sell agreement? That is that it's strictly tied to an arbitration, or it's the language is tied to an arbitration proceeding?
Exactly.
And which none was in this case.
Correct. There was no arbitration here. The parties decided to go to court as opposed to pursue arbitration. And the trial court has previously recognized, and I believe is the appropriate law, which is that attorney fee provisions must be strictly construed. The motion or the order awarding attorney's fees that's at issue here relies solely on the employment agreement as a basis for fees. And at page 3 of that trial court's order, the court itself acknowledges that the employment agreement, and I quote, upon which plaintiffs rely for attorney's fees and costs. And then the order goes on to get into a full discussion about the specific language in the prevailing party attorney fee provision of the employment agreement. There is no such discussion anywhere related to the buy-sell agreement. And the buy-sell agreement is never part of a motion or a request for fees in this case.
Why did you appeal the June 21, 2011 order awarding costs and fees?
There was no basis to appeal the award of costs and fees at that time.
Well, you were appealing the substantive decision on the buy-sell and the employment agreement and the cause versus the disability, right?
Correct.
And you filed your notice of appeal, and then the cost. I know the cost award afterwards, but why couldn't you just submit your notice of appeal? And I have to tell you, we see them pretty frequently.
Well, I think there's a couple of issues there, Your Honor. The first is that the cost and fee award does come out after the notice of appeal, but implicit in the appeal is any rulings that are dependent on the issue being appealed. The employment agreement was a principal basis of the appeal and the trial court's finding on that agreement. Implicit in this court's reversal is any rulings that are dependent on or ancillary to that appeal. And Dr. Bach did in her appeal say that she would like to preserve her cost, her right to costs and fees in the trial court. But to get into a full discussion, which is speculative, about the cost and fee award when there's no basis to go there yet, because there's no basis, we weren't arguing about the reasonableness of the fees.
Well, let me come back and ask you, in the briefs, in the first appeal, where in the briefs did Dr. Bach reserve the right to litigate further the attorney fees and costs issue in the trial court?
I think there's one comment in the opening brief about Dr. Bach requesting attorney fees to preserve her costs, her right to costs and fees in the trial court.
And that is a challenge to the award that's already been made by that point?
Your Honor, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that couldn't have been said more directly or artfully. I think it certainly raises the issue, but what I understand from Bainbridge is that the award is void when the basis for the award is overturned. And that premise can be raised at any time. The voidness of the judgment for attorney's fees can be raised for the first time on appeal. And so until that argument arises, which it doesn't arise until after this court makes its first determination.
I was going to say, you didn't assert voidness in the trial court as a part of your Rule 60 motion, did you?
We did. It's in the reply brief in the Rule 60 motion.
In the reply?
Yes. Yes.
And is a sir rebuttal or a sir reply permitted in that instance?
There was a sir reply filed in that instance, and that's where, for the first time, the issue of the buy-sell agreement comes up on the briefing. But yes, the issue of voidness was raised with the trial court, and Bainbridge was cited, and I believe also Nagy and Krishna Consciousness was cited in that briefing. But I'd have to, I know Bainbridge was for certain, as was Spencer, and the other two I'm pretty sure, but I'd have to look real quick.
That's okay, Counsel.
Counsel, Rule 60b-4 allows the court to give relief from a judgment that's reversed or vacated. Why is it 60b-4? Why are you backing away from 60b-4 and trying to rely so much on 60b-3?
I'm not, Your Honor. I embrace Rule 60b-4 because I think it is the most precise description of exactly what happened here. And it's why we cited and quoted that exact language. But we did not limit our motion to that provision. And the provision of 60b-3 about void judgments is equally applicable. So there are two bases under 60b, 60b-3 and 60b-4, and frankly 60b-5, which allows for any other reason justifying relief from the operation of the judgment that would apply in this case. And so the motion itself is titled a Rule 60b motion. The briefing encompasses the idea of voidness, but we quoted 60b-4 because 60b-4 is the most applicable to the circumstances here. The judgment, a prior judgment upon which a judgment is based, has been reversed or otherwise vacated. That was the exact reason that we thought provided the strongest basis for relief. And I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Jordan Factor, bar number 38126. With me at council table is Kenneth Skog, who represents Dr. Heidi Oster. However, I'll be handling the argument for appellee. This is an appeal of the denial of a 60B4 motion. The standard of review is abuse of discretion. The trial court, in adopting the reasons set forth in Horizon and Dr. Oster's response and certify, did not abuse its discretion in denying this motion. Several of the arguments set forth in the response in the SIR reply adopted by the trial court include that Rule 60b-4 is an inappropriate vehicle for the relief that Dr. Bach was seeking, that Horizon remained the prevailing party under the employment agreement, even considering this court's order, and
How do they remain the prevailing parties even after the division's decision in the earlier appeal?
Because Horizon prevailed on the disputed argument that, number one, Dr. Bach could be terminated. Dr. Bach challenged the right of Horizon and Dr. Oster as a 50% member of Horizon to terminate her at all. Dr. Bach challenged the notion that even if she were terminated, that she would be forced to sell her membership interests. She challenged...
And I thought those were claims raised under the buy-sell agreement.
So the trial court viewed the...
Is that right, counsel?
No.
Claims raised under the buy-sell agreement?
In part, it's correct. The trial...
Where were those claims raised under the employment agreement?
So the court looked at Section 3.1 of the buy-sell agreement, which provides that a member must sell their membership interests if they are terminated for any reason, including disability.
So again, it's under the buy-sell agreement.
That part is under the buy-sell agreement. Dr. Bach challenged under the employment agreement that she was terminated at all. So the first question is, was she terminated under the employment agreement for any reason, whether for disability or for cause?
Wasn't her counterclaim based on the issue that she had been terminated, should have been terminated for disability rather than for cause?
Her counterclaim was that there was a breach of the employment agreement by terminating her, including by terminating her for cause. Her defense to the declaratory judgment claim of Horizon and Dr. Oster was that there should not be a declaration that she could have been terminated for cause. So the court looked at the employment agreement and the buy-sell agreement as necessarily intertwined, because the buy-sell agreement is triggered once an employee is terminated for any reason. But the first question was, under the employment agreement, should she have been terminated at all? Was there authority to terminate? And Horizon prevailed on that. And the trial court adopted that as part of its reasoning in denying the Rule 60B4 motion. And that was not arbitrary or unfair. Now, the primary reason why this does not amount to an abuse of discretion is because Rule 60B4 is not an appropriate vehicle for this kind of relief. Dr. Bach could have and should have either appealed the express ruling in the February 1st order that Horizon was the prevailing party, or she could have asked the trial court to stay briefing on the attorney's fees motion pending resolution of the appeal of the February 1st order, or she could have taken an appeal of the June 21st attorney's fee.
Why isn't Bainbridge a Rule 60B4 in all but name? Why doesn't the Bainbridge authorize exactly what the appellant wants in this case?
Well, first of all, it's important that it's not Rule 60B4, even in name, because Rule 60B4 is a particular mechanism where you can go in a timely manner to the trial court and ask the trial court as an initial matter for relief from a judgment that essentially has no longer any force or effect, either because it's been satisfied through the payment of a judgment, or because a prior judgment on which it was based has been reversed or vacated. Now, there's not a lot of law on what that means, a prior judgment on which the judgment under attack is based. But the Tenth Circuit and other federal courts seem to be in agreement in saying that that refers to a prior judgment entered by another court which had collateral estoppel, res judicata effect. And therefore, the judgment that's under attack was wholly predicated on an earlier judgment without an opportunity for independent review going into the subject judgment under attack, such that when the underlying judgment no longer has preclusive effect, then there are some real due process problems with allowing a second judgment that was predicated entirely on the prior judgment, foreclosing any subsequent litigation or fact-finding or development of the record, to stand. At that point, once a prior judgment that had preclusive effect no longer has preclusive effect, then the second judgment should be lifted and there should be an opportunity for the litigants to litigate to a judgment based upon a new set of facts. That's what Rule 60B4 is intended to address. It's not intended to be a substitute for an appeal, which is exactly what is taking place here. Here, there was ample opportunity to...
Let me go back for a second. In Bainbridge, they did not toss the claim that was made on remand by saying, sorry, you're too late and you didn't appeal this other issue. They said, well, of course, the attorney fee award has to be considered a nullity. So why do you need a separate appeal when Bainbridge says you didn't need a separate appeal?
In Bainbridge, the parties did seek an initial appeal of the underlying cost award, and that didn't happen here. Here, there was never an attempt to directly appeal the cost award. As I recall, in Bainbridge, there were several appeals to this court, and the first judgment ultimately was reversed. It went back on remand. The trial court refused to set aside the cost judgment on remand. On appeal, this court said the trial court should not simply have relied on the first judgment still being in force and effect, but rather than instructing the trial court to set aside the cost award and award costs to the other party as a prevailing party, this court remanded for reconsideration to allow the trial court in the first instance to determine whether the party who was initially determined to be the prevailing party still is the prevailing party. This court did not remand with directions for the trial court to consider the other party the prevailing party.
But you're saying in Bainbridge there had been a remand order telling the court to consider the cost issue?
In Bainbridge?
One, in the prior appeal in Bainbridge?
Not in the prior appeal. In the appeal that appellant cite here, the appellate court said that the trial court erred in automatically considering the reversed judgment to still be the basis for a prevailing party determination, and therefore remanded for reconsideration of it, rather than instructing the trial court that actually the appellant is now the prevailing party. But that's not what we have here. First of all, we don't have an appellate order that completely reversed the order on which the attorney's fee award was dependent. That is what happened in Bainbridge. In Bainbridge, you had a trial court judgment that was completely reversed. And then you had this court saying, in light of the complete reversal of that order, you can't just assume that the initial prevailing party still is the prevailing party. We remand for additional fact-finding. Here, you have an affirmance in part and a reversal in part of an order. And the trial court on remand determined that notwithstanding this court's order reversing in part, that Horizon and Oster were still nevertheless the prevailing parties.
And tell me how they came up with that. As I understand, the trial court on remand said they were prevailing parties under the buy-sell agreement.
That was one of the reasons.
Then where else in the record does the court say on remand that it is also attributable, or they are still prevailing parties, and why are they still prevailing parties? Where does the court say that?
By adopting expressly the arguments made in Horizon's response brief and SIR reply. And amongst the arguments in the response brief and the SIR reply are what I recited this morning, which is that Horizon prevailed on several questions under the employment agreement, including whether Dr. Bach could have been terminated at all, and even if she were terminated, does that mean she must sell her membership?
Did Dr. Bach, in the first case, dispute the ability to terminate her?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, she did. And that was resolved ultimately on the resolution.
So she defended on the grounds that she should not have been terminated at all.
That was one of her grounds of defense, correct. And so now the question before this court is, does that amount to an abuse of discretion? Whether you would have reached the same conclusion as the trial court in the first instance or not, the question is, did the trial court act arbitrarily and unfairly in determining on remand, number one, that Rule 60b-4 is not to be used in this way, but number two, even if it is, the court is still going to consider Horizon and Dr. Oster, the prevailing party under the employment agreement.
I'm looking at the court's order that says prevailing party on the buy-sell agreement.
That's one of the grounds, Your Honor.
It doesn't say under the employment agreement on remand.
Your Honor, what the court says in its order, as you see, is for the reasons stated in Horizon's response, in Horizon and Dr. Oster's response brief and surreply. So it necessarily incorporated by reference those arguments, which busy trial courts need to do. If they are persuaded that all of the arguments set forth in one party's response brief or surreply brief or initial brief are persuasive, they can adopt it by reference, and it should be given the same deference by this court as if they had written their initial order, or if they had the parties draft proposed orders and they simply sign one side's proposed order, which is essentially the same.
And isn't there a body of law that says when one side drafts the order that we give effect to that order, but we're supposed to be very careful about reviewing that order?
Yes, you do need to review that order. However, if the standard of review based on the rule under which the court was deciding is abuse of discretion, it's still abuse of discretion. And here, the trial court did not abuse its discretion. Now, the last thing I want to hit on is this notion that it's void, which is a new argument on appeal under 60b-3. We don't think it can be raised for the first time on appeal, but even if it can...
They said they didn't raise it for the first time on appeal. They said they raised it in a reply brief.
That's not correct. They cite Bainbridge in a reply brief, but they do not say that it's void, and they do not cite to Rule 60b-3, and so the trial court did not have an opportunity to review this under Rule 60b-3.
And in your surreply, you didn't address Bainbridge or 60b-3?
Yes, we addressed Bainbridge. No, we did not address Rule 60b-3.
Okay.
However, really, this is of no moment because this is not void under 60b-3. And the best statement of that is from the Colorado Supreme Court in December of 2014. It's the Nickerson case, which is 339 P3rd 526, Penn site 529. And there, the Colorado Supreme Court says that a judgment is void if there is no personal jurisdiction or there was no subject matter jurisdiction, and therefore the order was a nullity from its inception. It had no legal effect from its inception. And that's why it makes sense that it can be raised at any time, because a court is free to examine jurisdiction at any time, but it's really a jurisdictional question, and that's not an issue here. And so we ask that this court affirm.
Just like to address a couple of the arguments of opposing counsel, and first and foremost, this argument that the trial court somehow found that Horizon and Dr. Oster remained a prevailing party. Not only is that not accurate, the trial court found the exact opposite in later proceedings.
Well, those later proceedings, we don't have a record before us.
And to the extent that this court has a question about who the prevailing party is, then this court's opportunity is to send the case back for that express determination.
Well, let me ask you this, counsel. Was your opponent correct that Oster and Horizon prevailed on an issue about proper termination under, or not proper termination, the ability to terminate under the employment contract?
No, Your Honor. Dr. Oster never argued that she could not be terminated. She argued that the disability provisions of the employment agreement control, and those required that the company wait 1 year after her disability in order to terminate her. And then once that year passed, then she could be terminated. She separately argued that until her interest was bought out in the company under the buy-sell agreement, that she was still entitled to profits. But that was separate from employment termination, and the briefing in the underlying case argues that she can be terminated.
I have a question, counsel.
Sure.
What about opposing counsel's position that, you know, all the reasons stated in any briefing they did on the Rule 60 can be considered in support of the trial court's remand? Is that what the trial court's order said?
That
for the reasons expressly stated?
They did say for reasons stated and because of the buy-sell agreement, but there were multiple reasons stated, and there was never a finding about prevailing party. I'm out of time. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Counsel, in our next case, people.